when you hear ED&I now, you'll probably think Black, Asian, minority, ethnic, LGBTQ, disability, health. Actually, diversity is not a group of people. It's a way of thinking and broadening your perspective on life. That's a cultural change. And inclusion is having a happy, healthy, engaged workforce, no matter who they are, where they come from, that feel part of your organization and feel empowered to be their authentic selves in work.
Welcome to the HR L&D podcast with your host, Nick Day. Tune in to discover what it takes to truly develop within human resources as we delve deep into growth, engagement, and leadership strategies that will help you unlock the hidden potential within your business. By listening to this podcast, we hope to empower you and your workforce towards achieving significant HR organizational success.
Welcome to the HR L&D podcast. My name is Nick Day, founder of JGA Recruitment. And today I am joined by Woosh Raza, senior HR leader, someone who is incredibly passionate about equality, diversity and inclusion, an expert in developing strategic people plans that align with organizational goals and leading high performance HR teams. Woosh is currently the head of HR and L&D at a brilliant charity called Phoenix Futures. Phoenix is a charity committed to supporting those who suffer from alcohol addiction or substance abuse, and the charity is well recognised in the sector. Now, Woosh has worked in senior HR roles for over a decade in the remit of generalist and as a leader of HR teams. So without further ado, let me welcome you all to Woosh Raza, an incredibly energetic, passionate and charismatic HR leader, to the HR L&D podcast. Enjoy.
Five quick questions. Understanding where we are to know where we are going.
Thanks for that intro, Nick. I hope I meet that benchmark in terms of energy and I have broken my podcast virginity this afternoon, which is always good. I currently head up HR and learning and development for a brilliant little charity called Phoenix Futures. Been with them not that long, but really getting immersed in the culture. And we've got some really exciting and ambitious plans. In fact, our CEO is speaking at the UK Drug Summit this week. She's in Scotland to speak to the Scottish Drug Summit as well. Very, very passionate campaigner about the stigma involved in those suffering an addiction. Maybe alcohol and substance abuse. So we're a charity that provides support to people that have got an addiction, an alcohol addiction, substance abuse. And so that's kind of what I do at the moment. I love working for the third sector. I think there's a lot that HR can really do to add value in that sector. Not that I'm taking away from the other sectors, but it's a personal sense of fulfillment that I say I must have since starting kind of work my career in the third sector. I started my career, like most HR professionals will probably say, I stumbled into HR. I hate to admit that now because I love it so much. So when people go, how did you start? And I haven't got the whole, I've been wanting to do it. It's been on my poster since, my bedroom since I was three. It's definitely not one of those. Basically started within the banking sector. And I guess that was my first exposure on regulatory and compliance risks. And it was about the time of the Lehman Brothers crash. So we went from being super, super cool with all of our mortgage advisors and kind of, bankers doing X, Y, and Z to enforcing a level of regulation very, very quickly. And being part of HR was a really interesting, for me, my first stint to really see what happens in the face of increasing regulation in the world of work and how HR play a role in terms of policy and procedures. And I did that for a while before I moved into healthcare. Moved into healthcare because I just love working more with health and well-being is something I'm really, really super passionate about. So I really wanted to kind of see another regulated environment, because it is, but more working with people hands-on. So I started my career, so developed within the NHS. I moved on to Priory Group, which is a private mental health provider. Did some great work there. And then more recently, I've then developed very senior HR roles, reporting into kind of board level and being responsible for a bigger chunk of people strategy and leading quite large teams as my career has progressed. And that's been largely in the social care and health and social sector. So kind of moving away from hospitals and then looking at communities and how we support people in the communities, actually. So we know there's a huge amount that we can do within our own communities that can stop people from needing emergency treatment, whether that's A&E, whether that's suicide, whether that's learning disabilities. We know how much more we can invest in our social care in the communities to take away the pressures that the NHS has at this moment in time. And so that, again, you know, that again, spurred my interest in communities as a wider concept and equality and diversity. And yeah, that's what's brought me to your lovely podcast this afternoon. That's kind of a flavour of who I am, what's important to me. I should add, you know, I identify as being gay, quite loud, actually. and quite, you'll know. I do have a flamboyant nature in the sense that I'm really passionate about bringing my energy and my personality into the world of ED&I. I'm also Pakistan. Well, my mum and dad are from Pakistan. And for me, that's really another very important part of my identity, who I am. And so a specific area of ED&I that I'm particularly, I would say, interested in and developing expertise in is intersectionality. So where people have potentially more than one area, you know, that is what you would call a protective characteristic. So whether that's, you know, being LGBT and a person of color, or having a disability and being a woman, you know, looking at those intersectional identities and how that adds a level of like a dimension to the life.
I think it's equally as important. You may not realize this, Roosh, but actually you're one of the first sort of HR, senior HR professionals I've had on the HRND podcast, because typically I've tried to locate people that I interview who influence the sector from outside. So, you know, there are many, many other podcasts that speak to HR directors and HR managers on a regular basis, and I didn't want to saturate that by adding another podcast that does the same thing. So I've really tried to find talkers that can have expertise that can influence the way HR moves and can assist with some of the challenges they face. But actually, your passion for what is really a challenging area of HR and L&D teams face at the moment, which is addressing equality, diversity and inclusion. I thought, you know what, you've got so much passion and experience and expertise to share with the HR professionals that do listen to this, that I really wanted to tap into that knowledge. So I guess if you don't mind me starting there, really, is because of that passion, what do you think businesses can do about addressing the challenges that HR teams and learning and development teams are facing at the moment when it comes to addressing ED&I issues?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think the answer, and this isn't a cop-out, I do think I've done ED&I work, tailored specific work for different organisations at different scales. And the strategy that I end up coming out with, or the work plan that we agree on, or the objectives, actually, the broader goals, and do really vary once you get a really good conversation going. So I think number one challenge for me, right, is yes, it's a hot topic. Yes, we're all talking ED&I. Yes, we're woke, as we like to say, in these issues. And, you know, there's a global attention to these issues that is accelerating the conversation at a pace that is exciting, but also quite nerve-wracking at the same time, because we're moving forward quite quickly with a lot of these issues. I mean, Harvey Weinstein this week and the you know, the verdict on that and actually what that represents. So that the global issues are impacting the ED&I conversation in work. And I think it can be really easy to detach from it and treat it as a clinical agenda item. And that's the first thing I would say, if you can try and avoid starting your ED&I conversation with that really detached mindset, then that's a good thing. Because actually what ED&I is, and we in HR, we try and pride ourselves on removing biases and removing discrimination and equality acts. So we've got a procedural approach in how we attack issues. But ED&I does not and will never work with a procedural approach. I think the first starting point and the challenges that I think I've seen is, how do you start a really sensitive conversation about what is going on in your business, about who works for your business, about what kind of cultures and behaviours that you are seeing, whether that's your business data or whether that's seeing it quite physically in the working environment. How do you bring that to a group of people, because you will need to bring it to your executive or your senior level teams, that are possibly very patriotic about their organisations, that are very proud of the organisations and the work that they do? Because as with any difficult conversation, to have a meaningful conversation, you need to be quite honest. So how do you bring that transparency and honesty in to start the focal point on what can we do to build a more inclusive culture. And do you see what I mean? And I think with what I've noticed, and this has been when I've been new to this sphere, is I had the energy and the excitement, the passion, but I found myself like freezing up when when directors would say, well, we don't have an issue, or you know, we've got loads of black people in the business, and we've got the pride, we put our pride floats out for London Pride every year, you know, there isn't an issue. And it's like, oh, okay, I'm going to recoil. I think there needs to be a level of, you know, trust that actually we need to be a little bit more vulnerable as an organization to be able to have that conversation about what we can do to further the conversation.
Do you think some of that defensible fear, if you like, comes from businesses actually knowing really that they're not doing enough? Do you think it's more to do with the fact that they're just fearful about even bringing the conversation to the table for fear of retribution or for fear of getting something wrong? Or do you think it's a combination of both of those things? Or are there other elements at play as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a mixture. I think there is a sense of anxiety, into the world of the unknown. So this is not a well-rehearsed, well-researched, I mean, there's a ton of research on ED&I, but in the grand scheme of business priorities, this is something that's emerging as a business, as a key area of business priority. And I think sometimes when people don't know well-trodden paths on how to address a problem, it can create a level of defensiveness because you know, you're not quite sure where the end goal is going to be. And I think that sometimes prohibits people from thinking, well, if I speak up and I don't know enough about it, or, you know, I'm a director, I should know about this. So sometimes that is sometimes where the conversation stops. And I think in other times it is good intentions. I mean, I will say, you know, I've worked with a range of CEOs on this issue and chief operating officers and various other directors. And some of them have got the most positive intentions. And it sometimes can get translated into potentially quite uncomfortable dialogue, in the sense that they want to say the right thing, they want to do the right thing, but they're not quite sure how to start that conversation or to work through it. Yeah. So I think it is a mixture of differences that prohibit people from having what I would call an honest dialogue on it.
Do you think some of that fear as well comes from the disproportionate kind of boards that we have at the moment? So I'll use myself as an example. I mean, you kindly invited me onto a panel to talk about these issues. I was the only white, Caucasian, middle-aged male on the panel. And I had some of that fear. I mean, I was definitely fearful of saying the wrong thing. I was obviously aware that, you know, I was the only white, Caucasian male on that panel. And I was the minority on that panel in terms of representing the white, Caucasian males in the group, right? So there was a fear for me. I mean, you have to confront the fear because we're trying to move forward. And if I turned down that invitation because of fear, then it doesn't progress what we're all trying to do as a collective, which is really promote equality, diversity and inclusion. But do you think it's because a lot of boards are made up of predominantly Caucasian, you know, white middle-aged males? Do you think that's part of the problem?
I do, absolutely do. I think there's two parts to what you've said. I absolutely agree. And thank you for being our white male representative in that conversation. Because what you so brilliantly did, and you did do this brilliantly, is that you recognised your privilege in the fact that so this is really interesting. I'm talking about this recently now on an article that I'm writing for a magazine, which is, Equality Act and equal treatment. The philosophy has been treat how you would, everyone needs to be treated fairly. But actually, if you're born into a societal structure where certain characteristics are given an advantage against others, then fair treatment isn't necessarily the answer to address the imbalance. And I think it's and I recognize my own privilege, although I haven't had a lot of privilege, you know, being a person of color and being LGBT. I definitely, you know, in both of the circles, both Asian and even within the gay community, actually, the racism I experienced in that community in particular. But actually, as a man, I recognise I have certain privileges, specifically in the world of work, I think, in terms of the way that, you know, maternity is treated, example, as opposed to women. So I think the first part of that question is recognising privilege. And we know that board representation is not where it needs to be. We've seen this year that we've seen a 7.4% decrease in people of colour at board level, which is shocking, given, you know, people, we've been having this conversation for however many years now. So there is that to play. There, I think groupthink is what can happen, which is too many of the same type of people at decision-making level, rightly or wrongly, coming up with ideas to address the issue, and they may not necessarily be the right ideas for the workforce because they're not including a diverse range of voices in the conversation. I think the other part to that is the white male. I think some activists, some really passionate activists, or in the conversation, somehow the white man has been branded as kind of the root cause of all diversity and inclusion issues in terms of societal structures and makeups and privilege. But actually, white men in particular need to be part of the conversation. And I don't want to just limit it to white men. What I think that diversity inclusion is a concept. It's a way of thinking. It is thinking that, okay, I have my own biases, I have my own views, I have my own life experiences, but they might not be the same as someone else. Whoever that someone else is, it just needs to be someone who is not representative of you or who is not similar to you. And by that definition, everyone should be involved in diversity, equality, and inclusion. But what we're doing now is the diversity fatigue issue, which is people hearing, especially white men, hearing equality and diversity initiatives at work or when they're in work, meetings, etc., and then feeling alienated from that conversation. That's not going to do any justice to progressing the agenda because the conversation needs to involve everyone. So there's that, which is the psychosocial element and the conceptual element of diversity and who that includes and why it's important to everyone, regardless of who you are, what privilege you may not have. The other side of that is, yeah, board representation, absolutely. And I mean, groupthink is the same. If I get together with a group of gay Asian men and start talking about how to develop maternity policies in the workplace, I'm pretty sure I'm going to be completely off the mark with what women in that workplace want. So I think there is a level of absolutely needs to have representation when decisions are being made around equality, diversity, and inclusion. And the best way to do that is to have a representative board, and a diverse board.
Yeah, I think you've summed that up absolutely. Absolutely brilliant. And without sort of, we can go down a tangent here, which was, there's so much evidence that proves that, more diversity leads to better profits and better financial performance for businesses, that really that it's very hard to find a business case, not to follow that angle. So it's almost surprising that more businesses aren't taking the approach that you're mentioning. One thing I'd like to just establish, because, I'm aware that I could be guilty of this here in the way that I lead this conversation, is it's very easy for us to group together equality, diversity, and inclusion as being one thing. So I wondered if you could just sort of explain how you perceive the differences are between these three terms. So how would you explain the differences between equality, diversity, and inclusion? Because otherwise I'm aware that I might just keep grouping them. And that's not something I necessarily want to do, but it's important also for the context of the conversation.
Absolutely. I must say I fell into the same trap when I first started researching the issue, and I was like, oh, equality, diversity, inclusion, what a great terminology. And it is, it does cover what we're trying to talk about. I had a great quote which I'm going to share, and I love this quote, and it's something that's really taken me far in the work that I do with in workplaces and at a consultancy on this. Is equality is having a seat on the table, diversity is being able to have your voice, to raise your voice and raise your issues, and inclusion is having that voice heard. And I think that's a great way of summing up the spectrum across equality, diversity, inclusion, because diversity is a reality, right? We live in a diverse culture. We come across people we would never come across more now than ever before, because of things such as immigration and migration, air travel. And so we're in contact with people from such different walks of life and different backgrounds and different communities in this point of time as mankind now, more than we've ever been. So actually, diversity is a reality. We know it's London in particular, very multicultural. And I think that's another part of the problem when it comes to setting up an ED&I strategy. It's not necessarily about attracting diverse people into the organization, because unless you're doing something so wrong, you're probably going to get a healthy level of applications, and if not, you need to have a look into the attraction side. But it's then how do you develop an inclusive culture within your organization? So how do you get employee voice amplified across your diverse communities? Are you recognizing that different people within your workforce have different needs? Are you talking about them? Are you challenging discriminatory practice in the most robust way possible, so that you have a zero tolerance approach to any level of discrimination? Are you educating your workforce on those issues so that you grow as an organization? That's what you would, in terms of inclusion and building inclusion, that's what's really, really important. So I think the distinction for me is equality is that we all want to be treated in a way that suits us, and that is reliant on culture and workplace and various other things. Diversity is by default is a reality that is just the world that we live in. And diversity is also a way of thinking. I think diversity, people completely, when you hear ED&I now, you'll probably think Black, Asian, minority, ethnic, LGBTQ, disability, health. Actually, diversity is not a group of people. It's a way of thinking and broadening your perspective on life. That's a cultural change. And inclusion is having a happy, healthy, engaged workforce, no matter who they are, where they come from, that feel part of your organization and feel empowered to be their authentic selves in work. So that's kind of where I see it.
No, I think you've described it. I think I preferred your version than the quote at the start. I'm going to include both. One question I'm keen to establish, and I don't know how this will be perceived, but I'll ask the question. Do you think as a society we are progressing or regressing? Because if you look at the media around, as you say, you mentioned diversity fatigue earlier, it seems to be everywhere in the press. Everyone's trying to talk about it, whether they're not talking about it in the right way or not, as another mentioned. But at the same time, I mentioned this on another podcast I did with Margaret O'Shea, which is, you know, in the public eye at the moment, I'm seeing, which I never thought I would see again. But I hadn't really been experiencing it, that things like racism in football, for example, had been all but eradicated with the Kick It Out campaign. And yet this year in particular, we've seen more examples of racism in the public eye than I probably can ever remember. So if you bring those two things together, do you think as a society and within the workplace that we are progressing or we're regressing? Or is there a bit of both?
Yeah. Again, really good question. And it is very depressing, I must say, in terms of what we're seeing in terms of some of these behaviours and incidents that we're seeing across the piece, actually. But I would say I'm optimistic that it is a bit of both. Okay, in reality, we are progressing on some areas, we're regressing on others. And I have asked, recently when I've been asked about diversity fatigue, because I've taken ownership of that terminology on those that are really fighting for equality as opposed to those that are sick of hearing of it, is it can get to a point where you think, God, despite all of the lobbying and campaigning and the global attention, you're still getting, like you say, racism happening in football. My answer to that is we are being heard. That is the first part of this, is for the first time these issues are being, the fact we're seeing reaction in my eyes is actually a positive, because people are reacting to what they're hearing. And that shows that some level of listening is happening globally. Now, whether that is going to mean that through a result of that listening, people are reverting to type or reverting to things that they know well, or entrenched ideologies and behaviours, or that they're opening themselves up to thinking about things differently, that is what we're seeing. Because some people are obviously, there is more of an appetite for people. I think organisations are probably taking the lead on what to do, because, ED&I, as you and I know, you've got now departments and teams of ED&I. You've got ED&I professionals in the workplace. You've got consultancies. You've got conversations happening in the workplace. I think organisations are taking their responsibility on this issue quite seriously. I think what we're also having to be mindful of is when you make change and when you're on the precipice of unprecedented, irreversible change, you will always have the resistance that we're seeing, which is we are dealing with secular, systemic and deep-rooted ways of living, ideologies, whether that's about what the man, between men and women, between people of colour, about race. These are concepts that as a human race, we have had to deal with or have established structures that have enabled us for hundreds and hundreds of years. And that will never go without a fight, really, for those that hold those ideologies deep rooted to them. We can see the political climate is not necessarily helping in progressing the agenda, because there is obviously a lot of dissatisfaction happening across the globe. You've got the rise of fascism, you know, with places like China, North Korea. You have presidents in the United States, dare I say it, but actually the views that they hold and the platform they have in able to express those views. Our own country, you know, I'm not getting into the politicals here, but, you know, we have a leader in post who's made some really inflammatory and quite discriminatory comments in previous times. So that isn't helping, because what that's doing is that's empowering and emboldening a base that feel like this conversation and that this agenda is taking away the comfort and the reality that they have known for a long, long time. So I think on the flip side, yes, we are regressing because we're seeing people act out. And necessarily that says a lot more about them than it does about the people championing for change. But on the flip side, we are making unprecedented changes in the sense that, you know, we've seen some massive milestones being achieved on the ED&I agenda in the last few years. So I think there's a mixture of things happening. And now, as a society, we are more tuned into this issue and more sensitive to this issue. So we're probably seeing those articles because we have an interest in it, you know, and that's also going to show us more of the worst, but also show us more of the best.
I think that's a really good synopsis of what's happening at the moment. And I think you've covered that brilliantly. So let's bring it back to the workplace then. You know, as an HR professional yourself, Luz, what do you think HR leaders can be doing or learning development teams can be doing at the moment to really combat the D&I challenges? I mean, you're right at the coalface of this. So what are the sort of day-to-day challenges you're seeing from an HR leader's perspective that other leaders listening to this right now are going to go, yeah, you know, you know what, we're faced with this at the moment. We're trying to do what we can, but we're hitting X, Y, and Z obstacle in making that happen. What are those challenges? And are there any solutions, or have you been able to find any solutions in terms of being able to break through them?
Solutions, I can definitely share some of my insights. And if others have solutions when hearing this podcast, please do get in touch. I think networking and sharing best practice is so key to this, and combining our efforts on this matter is massive. I think the issue of ED&I is sitting in HR, in the HR territory, in terms of where it's being allocated as a priority within teams and organizations. Do I agree with that? I'm not sure. I think that, as always, everything that is new or involves people or involves change or involves thinking about things differently, you know, sometimes these projects are packaged and then moved over to HR. And I love that, rather selfishly love that, because as a HR professional myself, I get to really lead on that work. But actually, are we best placed in the organization to be tackling this issue, or is it a collaborative approach? And I'd say start from that situation alone. And the way that I would encourage my other HR leaders is to think who's got the capability, skills, and actual genuine interest in the team to be able to take this forward. The reason I work with the CIPD on the range of events that we've showcased over the last year around equality and diversity, specifically for HR professionals, is that we are seen as an expert in this field, and I'm not necessarily sure we have educated ourselves to the level that we probably need to in order to tackle a really sensitive, complex piece of work such as ED&I. So my first question is, assess the capabilities and skills within your teams, in the HR teams, to see whether this actually fits within HR. And we still have a stigma in HR. So whenever a new initiative comes out in organizations and it's a HR-led, inverted commas, strategy or HR-led project, that can potentially alienate a lot of people from either not listening in or tuning into it or being involved in the work. So if you have got that kind of a culture where, you know, it's seen as a HR-led issue and that potentially that may not give you the traction you're looking for with your workforce, buddy up or get someone with influence at senior level to potentially champion the cause. One of the things I found that worked really well for me is when I've made it a broader strategic priority than just sitting solely within HR. So I've actually engaged with the director of operations, I've engaged with marketing directors, and I've said it'd be great to have your voices amplify this message. And I know it's because those two directors have got the largest teams in the business. So thinking about things a little bit smartly in terms of who's best placed to champion that message and how can we generate the interest across the workforce is probably a really good thing to think about from a beginning perspective. Educating the team is really important, you know, developing an understanding of what are the issues across equality, diversity and inclusion, what is groupthink, what is, you know, intersectionality in terms of identification. The other thing I think, and hearing from different voices and perspectives, and the best and most powerful way that I've seen that been achieved is ask your workforce. You will have someone with lived experience in certain areas, definitely within your workforce, that is tuned into what's happening right now, that would love to contribute their ideas and their experiences. You need to hear from those in your business that work for your business to get an insight into what it is that accurately reflects the work that you're trying to do. So do speak to a broad range of stakeholders, I think, and people from diverse backgrounds within your business to understand your culture and understand where you want your strategy to go. What other things can I think about? So I think
don't be fearful of the response.
Absolutely,
you know,
yeah.
Put it out there to
absolutely
ask your workforce. Yeah. And that's probably one reason people don't do it. You know,
they're worried that someone
like up and go, you don't do enough, but actually you need to have that feedback in order to make change.
Absolutely. And I found in my experience, if you find the right people, they're not, they will tell you as it is. But actually, you're right. There are people, like you say, potentially that where it's not a visible diverse, you know, where their characteristics aren't visible. For example, it might be their sexuality or another part of themselves who, yeah, like you say, you know, maybe a little need to be empowered to understand why you're asking them the question. And actually, yeah, like you say, recognize that you know, being honest and transparent is really going to benefit the organization. So I do think that really does help. We're all kind of learning how to talk about this issue. I think it's not to take away from that. We're going to say, I mean, I've heard some corkers of statements and terminologies that are used by CEOs and senior level directors on this issue. And I'm just like, wow, okay. But actually, I have to recognize that it's a conversation that we need to kind of have together. So I think honesty and transparency is absolutely fundamental for HR leaders. If you are in a position of trust with your senior directors and your exec, then encourage an honest dialogue to address what it is. And the biggest thing I've seen that I would say steer clear from for HR leaders is do not buy an off-the-shelf or a one-size-fits-all approach or product to try and address your issues.
And that almost contradicts what we're trying to achieve anyway, doesn't it? I mean, the whole point of ED&I isn't a one-stop solution to the problem.
Absolutely. You know? But you'd be surprised how many times I've heard senior people in HR go, oh, well, we've got a statement now at the end of every advert saying we're really keen on bringing diversity into the business. And I'm like, okay, please tell me your work does not stop there. And, you know, so that is, I think, a really key part of it is just you're right, absolutely, it goes against the very philosophy whereby we're trying to instill an individualistic approach. I think the other part is also your data can tell you a lot if you are asking the right questions and if you are collecting your data in the right way. So it could be really daunting to start off on this, but actually, why don't you start with some basics around your workforce composition? So what is your workforce made up of? And then take it from there. Then perhaps start to have some anecdotal conversations out in the business from a business partnering perspective and have a few focus groups to just get the conversation going, like what's working, what's not working well. I think what a lot of senior HR, including myself, I must say, when I did this project elsewhere and when I led equality diversity strategies, I would perhaps be quite presumptive in, oh, okay, these are the issues. Without necessarily, and this is because the data is telling me this. So for example, and I'll give you an example because I want to share my experiences. My last organization, it was like, well, we don't have a representation issue because 40% of the workforce are BAME. So we know we can attract people in, but what we need to do is look at how we make it more inclusive. And I don't know why I got to that without giving the research the respect that it needed, because yes, we had nearly half of the workforce identify as people of colour, but they were all working in frontline roles. And actually in the care sector, there is a higher representation of that. So we're not necessarily doing anything extra to get to get a diverse workforce. And what we were finding was, as you were progressing through management ranks, it would be progressively less the AME up to and including our exec team. So where it wasn't necessarily an inclusion issue, because actually they wanted to come in, and it was more a management and leadership development issue with the AME workforce. And I needed to do some further work on the data to understand that issue, and then talk to people that had been through processes, and they were like, well, I know I had the requisite skills and experience, but for whatever reason, Joe Bloggs was promoted over me, and I'm not quite sure why. I can't quite see that. And then I did some digging around actually unconscious bias and how managers are treating recruitment by sitting in on interviews, and seeing quite honestly that we did have a level of discrimination at senior management level about how we were making choices on people moving into management roles. And I couldn't have then developed approaches and solutions to address that without having to take those steps to understand the issue. Whereas from that initial set of data, I was like, oh, it's an inclusion issue. And so that's a piece of advice that I would give in terms of how you would just need to really drill down on your data and really supplement your data, get a range of different sources. So don't just look at your stats and your annual survey. How many times I've been relied on, and it was 2018. No, was it? Oh God, it was 2019 last year. I'm losing track of the years. And when I first got given this project, they were like, yeah, here's a staff survey from 2017. I was like, okay, well, that's 2 years out of date. B, I'm not quite sure what you want me to do with this. So it's just making sure that your data is really tuned in, doing the work. If you don't have the data, go out and get it and speak to people, as well as collecting more statistical and objective data. Subjective data is so rich if you get the right conversations going.
Fantastic. Well, you've given such a comprehensive overview there. I think it's almost worth rewinding this section for the last 5 minutes of you listening to this and going through it all again and taking some notes. And I love the fact you've introduced some personal experiences into that as well. You've touched upon technology, and so I'm going to pause that there because I want to talk to you about technology in the second part of this podcast. I think you've talked about a little bit in terms of the data side of things. Before we get to that point, though, Roosh, I'd love to find out a little bit more about you.
Time to find out more about you.
So just to take us off the ED&I narrative for a moment, how do you relax in your downtime? What motivates you outside of HR?
A range of things. I think mindfulness and well-being and mental health. I don't want to keep these buzzwords going in terms of how do I relax and unwind. I think I'm really passionate about HR and L&D professionals actually taking the time for them. And I'm a really big believer on that. So outside of work, I do like to focus on those things that matter to me. I love traveling, probably a little bit too much. If you speak to my other half, who's always like, how have you budgeted for this? Like, you don't have the annual leave entitlement, which is true. And B, oh my God, we literally, we need to save up. And I'm just I literally do love, if I can book a holiday, I'm there and seeing different parts of the world. And just, yeah, getting out there, I think, outside of my own little bubble in London. So definitely traveling energizes me. I think it's really important to have a good support network. And I love spending time with my friends and my family. It's probably another cliche that a lot of people say, but I genuinely get a lot out of talking to people, as you can probably tell from this podcast.
It's like the perfect medium for you, isn't it, podcasting?
It really is. I'm like, right, I'm getting comfortable in my chair now. Like, hey. But yeah, no, I do. I love
your fiance is going to owe me. You're going to go home and you'll be completely silent. You're like, what happened?
He will. He'll probably drop you a little thank you note. But yeah. So yeah, that's talking, socializing. I love my long baths and just chilling out. I love cooking. For mindfulness, I do actively. I don't know if I was getting it right when I first went on the mindfulness bandwagon. We know how, and I've worked in mental health, so the Priory and various other mental health providers. So I had the opportunity to really pick therapists and psychotherapists' brain. Okay, how do you actually do it? What is mindfulness? But actually, I'm really heavily massive fan of that, which is just taking 10-15 minutes to focus on what's around you and to let go of everything else that you're thinking through. And I do that religiously before I go to work and as soon as I get back home.
I mean, there's a fear associated with that as well, isn't there? Everyone, there's that fear that you have to sort of sit in the lotus position.
Yeah,
We don't quite understand what it is, and we people get used to it. They adopt it.
Absolutely, you have to make it work for you. And you're right. You can do it once you've tapped into that part of that your mind that puts you at ease and stops, because for me it's about a million thoughts an hour that come through my head, whether it's my team or about things that I need to do at work or plans I have with my friends, etc. So for me that is so important. On the go, I'm literally walking to work, and you just, once you know how to access that part and just shut everything else out, honestly it is the most it's refreshing, actually. Just as refreshing as a gin and tonic, which is something else that I quite like to do in my own time.
I heard that at one of the CIPD panels you arranged, you even had a gin station.
I actually blew the whole budget for the event on alcohol, and was reprimanded, rightly so, by CIPD. They were like,
it's my kind of panel.
Yeah.
I like that. So who are the two people who have been most influential to you in your career?
Oh, very, very, wow. Oh, that's a good question. I think the one that particularly stands out in my head is a hospital director that I worked with at the start of my career. And she was, and I was, you know, sharing now, I was quite enthusiastic, quite motivated. You know, I got into a senior HR role relatively young. I was 22, actually, when I took up my first HRM role. And that was a learning curve. And I was like, yeah, no, I got this. And I had the gift of the gab, as you can probably tell. And I could say the right things in the right meetings and wow the right people, and SMT loved me, etc. But what I really wasn't good at was the detail. And, you know, actually going away after a meeting, typing up notes, doing reports, you know, putting my statistics together. And it did land me in a bit of trouble with that. So this had been allowed to go on, and they kind of, there was this, you know, no one had really checked me in, because I would always get away with it in terms of, oh no, it's fine, I can on the hoof, I can say what I need to. And I was at a stage of my life as well, you know, I was quite young. And I remember when she took over the hospital from the last hospital director, and she within the first month she said, right, I need this and this. And of course, I didn't do any of it, because I was, you know, for me, I really enjoyed the speaking part of the job and not necessarily the doing in terms of the analysis and all that. And she sat me down and she went, right, this is going to be painful, Wish, but I'm now going to give you a crash course in how to have attention to detail. And you don't have that. And it was the first honest conversation I think I've ever had in the workplace, because until then I was like, oh my god, you're great, you're this, you're that, and I had this really positive feedback, and she was the first one to sit me down, really neutral, really, you know, she did it well, but she basically said, address this. And we painstakingly, being the opposite word, weekly would then sit, and I hated it, I absolutely hated it. And she'd be like, right, I've reviewed your report, this is my feedback from your report, and and she sat me down and she'd be like, I like your thinking on this, but have you thought about this? And that coaching, I guess it was coaching, wasn't it? It was quite intense. And it equipped me with the skills that I think I still use to this day, which is, you know, we are absolutely, you know, the profession of people is changing. We are more, you know, in a space where we talk and culture and change. That's why I love HR and people, because it's about people now, right? So, but we still have a role in organizations to manage risk, to provide, you know, administrative support and resources, to have an attention to detail when it comes to processing various pieces. And that, without developing that skill, I don't necessarily think I'll be able to line manage the teams that I do in the way that I do now, having understood the full range of services that we provide. So she definitely sticks out in my mind as someone who gave it to me like it was. She was so great because she didn't have a massive personality. She's quite introverted, actually. And I'm massively extroverted, as you probably tell. And it was great because she showed me a different side and a different approach to effectiveness in the world of work. Really opened my eyes to that. So, yeah, she's the one that I really carry with me, I think, in the lessons that she taught. I think the other person in my career, I think there's so many inspiring people right now. I must say one of the people that I have a huge amount of respect and admiration for is Charmaine D'Souza. I don't think she's going to listen to this. She's the HR director of the Greater London Authority. And I've had the privilege of meeting with her a few times, and being offered some mentoring as well through her, which I've yet to kind of start, actually. But in terms of the work that she's done in GLA, the I think in terms of the mayor's commitment to equality and diversity, and seeing that in terms of TFL, the apprenticeship programs that have been brought in, the focus on disability in such a holistic way, you know, the amount around the equality and diversity agenda, not only impacting the team, her team, and the work that they're doing with the GLA, which is a huge workforce, but then the knock-on effect that's having on London, and in the midst of Brexit and all of the feelings of perhaps feeling unwelcome, etc., especially for our European, you know, people living and working in London. I'm really inspired by that, by the approach that they've taken. And it's really actually quite, you know, bold in the way that they've gone, nope, we are London and we believe in diversity. We believe in, you know, the people that live and work for us. And, you know, the work that I've seen Charmaine champion and do in the various committees and forums that I've seen her operate in is really inspiring, I think. And it shows me what good leadership can do in the sense of really moving this kind of agenda forward.
Two excellent examples. Fantastic. So are there any resources that have really helped you on your journey?
Networking as a resource is massive, I think, and it shouldn't be underestimated. I think if you can get along to any events, seminars, forums, there's loads of free ones because those people are, you know, are kind of doing this. I think that's been a huge help. And honestly, in the equality diversity space, that's probably been the most, because some of these conversations are about people and about different experiences. And because it's new to us in the sense that it's not an established part of business and we're like, you know, it's developing, it is so helpful to hear about other people's experiences and how they've done it. So I would absolutely recommend as a resource, go to an event, go to a seminar. I might plug the CIPD Central London here and say we've got a range of events coming up in the following year that are tailored around both the educational piece, because I'm really passionate about us educating ourselves on some of these issues, but also the networking and meeting different people and hearing about different ideas and thoughts. So that's definitely a resource.
That's also how we met as well, and how we got to this point. So it shows the power of networking. And there may or may not be a gin station. So
you know, if they refresh my budgets this year and they give me something decent, then yeah, I will commit to, you know, an alcohol as a treat there.
If you could invite three people to a dinner party, who would they be and why?
Oh God. Okay. Oh God, this is probably really random. So I'd invite Rihanna because she's like my absolute goddess in life. For those of you, for those people that know me on a personal level, I have been a huge fan of her. She's the same age as me. I feel like I've grown up with her. I love her music. I love the fact that she's totally shaken things up in the world of equality and diversity. I mean, Fenty Beauty, that she's now catering for all skin tones. I mean, she just did it. Like, she just like, nope. You know, people need to have foundation at every different type of skin tone possible. She just made it a success and it's massive. She's a huge businesswoman as well as, you know, a massive brand. I have such mad respect for her and love for her. I would love to have her around for dinner just to pick her brains and experiences. The other person I probably want would be amazing is Indra Nooyi. So I'm not sure if people know the name Indra Nooyi, but she was the CEO for PepsiCo for a number of years, I believe about 14 years, who pretty much doubled Pepsi's profits under her. She brought the new Pepsi Well Living range in. She diversified Pepsi's portfolio. And she started her life and her, I guess, her early start was in India, where, you know, as a woman of color, or as women in India anyway, access to education was not easy. She was very lucky to have been brought up by progressive family members that really encouraged her, both her and her sister, to actually go to university. She did that off her own back. She then came to Harvard. She got a scholarship to come into the USA. She got obviously management consultancy qualifications through Harvard, and then started working at Pepsi. She'd been in Pepsi for a long, long, long time and progressed her way through to a position of, you know, being a woman of color on a FTSE 100 company. And this is talking 15 years ago, you know, in terms of her achieving that. I would absolutely love to hear more about her journey and the, you know, what insights or I guess some tips, you know, or sharing her thoughts on the future. And who was my final person? Jeff Bezos. I'd probably be a bit scared, to be honest, of him. apprehensive. But the reason I've chosen Jeff Bezos is I think Amazon is reaching a point in time as an organization that is truly, it's scary, but it's remarkable how they've grown from in his garage selling books to the massive worldwide conglomerate. I mean, I know people are scared because, you know, Alexa's listening to everything we're saying now, apparently, and all this data is being collected. But for me, I'm thinking there is that, which is the ethics and data part of it, which is we Amazon's entire philosophy has been customers, and actually we need to know everything about our customers so we can give them the best possible service. And they really do now know pretty much everything if you think about what we use Amazon for. So there's that. I just want to be like, okay, you know, how do you unwind? Because he's like, isn't he like the richest man in the world or the second richest man in the world? So I'd love to pick his brain. That would be my three. If that happened, I'd probably have a heart attack.
It'd be a pretty powerful dinner. So we've got Rihanna, Indra Nui and Jeff Bezos. And I think Indra was, my research here tells me that she was voted 13th most powerful woman on the Forbes list. So that gives you some ideas to... Of all female entrepreneurs, so yeah. So I'll put a link in the episode notes to all three, so people who are interested in finding out more, people can click on those links and see why I've invited them. So fantastic guests at the dinner party. We're going to move back into the deep detail of ED&I. We're going to go for a quick advert break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the technology that hopefully you think might be able to help with addressing ED&I issues. So stay with us.
Have you ever asked yourself, how can any recruiter understand my HR recruitment challenges? Please don't give up on your hiring challenges just yet. Here at JGA HR Recruitment, we appreciate the difficulties associated with attracting, recruiting and retaining top human resources talent. We also understand just how costly a poor hire can be. JGA HR Recruitment would like to partner with you to help you overcome your hiring challenges. Contact us today on 01727 800 377 or visit jgarecruitment.com to find out more.
Shaping the future of human resources together. Final questions.
I would like to ask, Bush, how do you think technology can help us in addressing ED&I?
A really good question. I think the question should be, what should you be mindful of if you are using technology to support ED&I? Because I think it can help. But actually, I was at the annual conference and exhibition for the COPD last year, where we had some really inspiring discussions. And it was touched upon around actually what are not the drawbacks, but I guess some of the risks that we're also seeing when it comes to AI and technology and ED&I, because you can map racial profiling now, which is an interesting, very ethical area of debate, which is really, yeah, which can, it depends how it's being utilized. But I think I guess if you look at it from my perspective in the world of work and organizationally, I guess what I'm seeing, there are some huge benefits to using technology. I mean, I know people probably may have heard of this, but removing unconscious bias. It's probably, you know, one area in particular that can a recruitment platform can help with. So we had Devyani on our panel at the event, didn't we? And we had the various discussions at my last event for Equality and Diversity on how you can remove that level of screening so that there is, I guess, a level of impartiality, and that will potentially combat your managers, in the sense that if there is shortlisting practices that are discriminatory, it removes that. So what you can, technology is a great way to enable a broader talent pool to enter your organization. But actually, for me, the other areas of technology, I think, is measuring data and using that data to inform a picture of where your organization's at. Because even if you remove as many barriers through technology, which, by the way, you can absolutely do through effective learning management systems, applicant tracking systems, HRISs, you can do that. But if you still have a bad manager sitting behind the technology, or, you know, bad practices happening that's not effectively going to support your organizations in moving forward. So it is a two-pronged attack, I think.
I love that response. What you've just said there tackles actually a lot more issues outside of ED&I. When we talk about the tech fear of people bringing in AI and robotics, and are they going to outsource my job, and is it going to make an effect? As you say, it's only going to be as strong as the people managing it and the people looking after it properly. And if we become over-reliant on technology doing everything for us, then we're going to be in a real sticky mess, I think, in the longer term. So I think that's across the board. But I just thought I'd interject, because I really love that response, and it's something I'm passionate about.
And I agree. I totally, totally agree with you, Nick. I could not agree more. I think you're right. It does straddle so much more than ED&I. It's culture. It's people's, the whole process. You bring technology in, if you're operating it with people that, with the wrong people, for being a frank, it's never going to give you the desired effect. And you are right. It covers a lot broader area in terms of talent, leadership, various other pieces. I think where I've seen technology in ED&I work really well is measuring so engagement. So one of the things that we talk about in the world of equality and diversity is tribes and communities and bringing communities together, because we are moving, well, I'm certainly a huge advocate and champion of using technology to bring cultures together. So I work in an organization that has about 30 or 40 different sites and services located across the country. How do you bring people together in that, in the sense that they feel part of one organization? And technology is a great way to enable that. But by default, you're also then furthering your ED&I agenda, in the sense that if you see other people from different backgrounds and different experiences and are able to connect to other parts of your organization outside of what you could traditionally do, because you work in, say, potentially a non-diverse team, or you're not exposed to different people, technology is a great way to bring people and bring experiences together. So a few platforms that I've used, I think Totem being one of them, which is a great platform. Workplace, which is an app by Facebook for work, and that's great, because you kind of have the gamification element there, and it's drawing on things that people are familiar with in their own outside of work, in terms of liking and sharing, etc. So I think there's a massive benefits on the cultural piece. On the ED&I front, there's obviously platforms that you can get recruitment wise that can remove your unconscious bias. But again, like we've talked about, I think that needs to be supplemented with training to hiring managers on how to shortlist and how to use the systems. I think there's a whole data and ethical piece there as well, which is, you can collect data as long as you understand what you're using it for and how you're using it. Those are, engagement measuring apps, pulse surveys, now we see it so much, don't we, where we go to shops or Amazon or Uber. This is all on that instant feedback principle. So you can say, how was my service today? Or how, rate your driver 4 stars out of 5 stars. Bringing some of that in to measure your engagement and your workforce is a great way of also identifying particular issues around equality, diversity and inclusion. So I think some of those ideas potentially could help enable it. But, I've seen it where you go, don't jump straight to the technology without addressing the people that work for you in the first instance, I think.
Yeah, makes total sense. So, just taking it forward, in your view, what do you think? We've talked a lot about what people can do and some strategies for improving ED&I within the workplace. What are the common pitfalls that you're seeing organisations fall into when it comes to ED&I?
This is a good question. Again, some of these vary much so depending on how much buy-in you've got, but the first part is groupthink. I think first area I've definitely seen happen is groupthink. By groupthink, I mean, yes, we want to do some work on equality, diversity and inclusion. Yes, we want to make our business or make our organization a better place to work. But the people that are getting together to make those decisions aren't necessarily diverse. So I would say always try and get a group of people from different. It doesn't need to be diversity in the sense that different departments, different areas of the organization, different backgrounds, different views, get a diverse group, pardon the pun, together to address your ED&I strategy. I think that's the first pitfall I think I see is right decisions, wrong people, probably how I would call it. Or right thinking, wrong people. And I think the other area is...
And that includes age as well, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
We haven't really touched upon age.
Yeah.
You're talking about diverse points of views. It's all ages as well as, you know, people can have different experiences and different ways of thinking to bring that to the table.
Absolutely. And you're right, age is definitely an area that, you know, we not overlook, but it's definitely an area of diversity. You want to bring in different people from, you know, different, from getting a broad range of people is really key. I think the other rest, I know we talked about this, touched about this earlier, but do not try and create a strategy that you've seen on LinkedIn or that you've heard someone talk about their 18-step plan in a conference, etc. It's really easy not to pinch people's work, but we always like the comfort blanket of seeing something tried and tested and know that it can produce the right results. There's nothing wrong with that, but I think there is something, there's nothing wrong with actually that, but what is EDI is the one area, I think, or one space that you will not get a realization of benefits from following a policy or a strategy or a work plan from other places. And that's because every single organization is different. Another pitfall I've seen is we're like, oh yeah, we're going to do a huge piece in EDI. We're going to get a BAME forum set up, an LGBT forum. We're going to go down to Pride. We're going to put posters all over the walls, make it meaningful, and make it relevant to your organization. I think that's another huge, I think, takeaway, in the sense that everyone will have a different, every organization will have a different need when it comes to addressing EDI. So take the time and the data to think through what that need is. I think the final area I would like to say is on the pitfalls is I laugh when I hear people go, oh, you mean the nice fluffy EDI stuff? No, like there's nothing nice and fluffy about this subject matter. And actually what I've seen with people in organizations is it's seen as a nice to have or an add-on and not a core part of your business strategy. The only way you are going to get the buy-in, the influence, people to sit up and pay attention is if you are linking your or weaving your EDI strategy through your business goals. So if you have a business goal of being 90% of your services to be delivered digitally in the next year, how can EDI, what we can see is actually with that, our IT department is not representative of the customers that we support. So they're not understanding this. So diversification of your IT department. So start to make meaningful actions to address your EDI plan through linking it to your business goals. And that will get the attention of your executive team. It will get the attention of your CEO, and it will get the attention of the people that work for you. I think those are the key pitfalls that I've definitely had to navigate through in recent years.
No, you've articulated those brilliant. And for those that listened to my podcast in the past or have listened to me talk with Margaret in the previous podcast, you'll know that. And I don't mean to kill the lily by mentioning this again, but you know I'm passionate about this from a recruitment perspective. Stop looking for things that are a culture fit, in inverted commas. We're looking for people that are going to evolve your culture. There's all the evidence is out there to suggest that diversity leads to better profits, to you know stronger practices. So let's look at evolving your culture when you're recruiting, and stop using the wrong culture fit as a reason for not taking a more diverse workforce into your organization. So I'm really, really passionate about that. We need to take that out of the vocabulary of a recruitment practice. The culture fit is old, it's antiquated. We should be evolving cultures. And I think if we do that as a collective and use that alongside the three great points you've just raised, then we're going to be in a much better position going forward. And businesses are going to be much better for it because, as you say, all the evidence is there to suggest that diversity leads to better profits, better performance. You know, it takes 2 seconds to do some research into this area and you'll see the results speak for themselves. So, you've given some great examples of pitfalls for people to avoid, which is fantastic.
I love that, Nick. Culture evolvers. Yeah, no, that's a good, really good way of looking at it. Absolutely.
100%. It's something I'm quite passionate about. So you'll see me suddenly come to life with that kind of area. But I'm trying to educate every client I speak to when they say they've got to be the right culture. And I'll say to them, what does that really mean? You know, this is your opportunity to not replace the person you've lost with a like-for-like individual. This is your opportunity to pick someone that gives all the skills and experiences that you didn't have in the person you've just lost. So let's rethink it. So this almost brings us to the end of the podcast, which I'm ashamed to say because you've got so much passion for it and I could listen to you all day. But I would like to ask you if you could...
one of few that could listen to you
all day. I don't believe that's true. So for those that are listening to this right now and they're really passionate, they're passionate about making a difference, they're passionate about doing something different, that they've listened to all the advice you've given, what's the one thing they could immediately walk away from this podcast with and say, okay, I've listened and I'm immediately going to make this change in my business? So it might be an HR professional, it might be a business owner, but is there an implementable action that someone can immediately walk away from this podcast right now and go, right, let's change this? And if there is, what would that be?
Try and have one conversation with one person in your organization to talk openly, honestly, frankly about what are the ED&I issues that we are facing in the business. And if you can try and have that conversation with someone, it doesn't need to be an exec, it doesn't need to be a director, it doesn't need to be someone you work with every single day. It could be someone that you don't have that, someone who is different to you, and I'll leave it with people to, you know, interpret that as they will, someone that you may not necessarily gravitate to both personally or professionally, and have an honest conversation about the experiences and challenges. Not only is that an educational piece on different perspectives and different ideas, that will give you an idea of where to take the conversation next. And that, for me, for three of the six, and I'm really proud of the strategies I've implemented over the last 5 years in various places, has been my golden ticket every single time, because that has set me on the path to then having those, you know, progressing that conversation through. So if you can do that, I'd highly recommend that you do.
Fantastic. And as you've mentioned as well, to summarize some of the other points you've talked about in this podcast, you can then, you know, when you start having those conversations, you can start analyzing that data to build compelling cases for addressing ED&I issues. You can look at some of the ER cases which are centered on discrimination and look at the feedback that staff surveys are telling you about D&I to make some changes. You can link that to your corporate strategy, and you can really use that to drive evidence-based and meaningful conversations. So, what a pleasure to have you on board today. I hope you've enjoyed your first podcast.
I've loved every moment of it. I'm so super thankful for you having me on, Nick. Really enjoyed it. It's been a great conversation.
I've enjoyed every second. I know you've mentioned a couple of times you're a really keen networker. So if I may, I would love to put your LinkedIn profile in the episode notes. So if people are interested in connecting with you online, they can do so just by clicking the episode notes and finding your profile to go straight through to yourself. Are there any other places people can find you online that you're happy for them to locate you?
Useful links, keeping the HR L&D community connected.
I'm really active on LinkedIn. So yeah, please do add the details, Nick, which I'm sure you... And if anyone does want to reach out, please drop me a message. I'm really responsive and always happy to share what's worked for me and have that conversation. So please do reach out.
Absolutely fantastic. And of course, if you are an HR or L&D professional listening to this podcast and you have an HR, HIS or L&D related vacancy and you want some specialist HR recruitment support, please do get in touch with me. I would love to help you. I'd love to show you what a good HR or a great HR experience can feel like when it comes to recruitment. You can reach out to me directly at nick@jgarecruitment.com or give me a call 01727 800 377. Otherwise, as always, thanks for listening. I look forward to bringing you all the next episode of the HR L&D podcast real soon, and thank you ever so much, Roosh Raza, for joining me today on what has been a fantastic episode. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for tuning into the HR L&D podcast with your host, Nick Day of JGA HR Recruitment. If you need help with a current HR or L&D vacancy, then please get in touch with Nick and his team. All contact details can be found in the episode notes. In the meantime, to make sure you never miss an episode, please subscribe to the show through any of your favorite podcast channels. Till next time.